Gated road accidents, one of them quite nasty, where that had happened with cigarette butts. He took his notebook from his back pocket, carrying it was second nature, administrative leave or not, and printed Tommy and Tup on a blank sheet. He replaced the van Subaru box on the shelf it had come from, left the evidence room, not neglecting to jot down his out time, and relocked the door. When he gave the key back to Sandy, he held his notebook open in front of her. She glanced up from the latest adventures of Jennifer Aniston to glance at it. "Mean anything to you?"
"Nope."
She went back to her mag. Ralph went to Officer Gould, who was still entering hard copy info into some database and swearing under her breath when she hit a wrong key, which seemed to be often. She glanced at his notebook.
"Tup is old-timey British slang for screwing, I think. As in, I tupped me girlfriend last night, mate. But I can't think of anything else. Is it important?"
"I don't know. Probably not."
"Google it, why don't you?"
While he waited for his own out-of-date computer to boot up, he decided to try the database he was married to. Jeannie answered on the first ring and didn't even need to think when he asked her.
"It could be Tommy and Tuppence. They were cutie poo detectives Agatha Christie wrote about when she wasn't writing about Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple. If that's the case, you'll probably find a restaurant run by a couple of British expats and specializing in things like bubble and squeak."
"Bubble and what?"
"Never mind."
"It probably means nothing," he repeated.
"But maybe it did.
You chased this shit to make sure, one way or the other. Chasing shit was, apologies to Sherlock Holmes, what most detective work was about."
"I'm curious, though. Tell me when you get home."
"Oh, and we're all out of orange juice." "I'll stop by Gerald's," he said, and hung up. He went to Google, typed in Tommy and Tuppence, then added restaurant. The PD computers were old, but the Wi-Fi was new and fast. He had what he was looking for in a matter of seconds. The Tommy and Tuppence Pub and Cafe was on Northwoods Boulevard in Dayton, Ohio. Dayton. What was it about Dayton? Hadn't it come up once before in this sorry business? If so, where? He sat back in his chair and closed his eyes. Whatever connection he was trying to make, courtesy of that yellow bra strap, continued to elude him. But this new one he got. Dayton had come up during his last real conversation with Terry Maitland. They'd been talking about the van, and Terry had said he hadn't been in New York since he honeymooned there with his wife. The only trip Terry had taken recently had been to Ohio. To Dayton, in fact.
"The girls' spring vacation, I wanted to see my dad."
And when Ralph had asked if his father lived there, Terry had said,
"If you can call what he's doing these days living."
He called Sablo. "Hey, Yoon, it's me."
"Hey, Ralph, how's retirement treating you?"
"It's good. You should see my lawn. I heard you're getting a commendation for covering that dipshit reporter's delectable body."
"So they say. Tell you what, life has been good for this son of a poor Mexican farming family."
"I thought you told me your father ran the biggest car dealership in Amarillo."
"I might have said that, I suppose. But when you have to decide between truth and legend, essay, print the legend. The wisdom of John Ford and the man who shot Liberty Valance. What can I do for you?"
"Did Samuels tell you about the kid who originally stole the van?"
"Yeah, that's some story. Kid's name was Merlin. Did you know that? And he sure must have been some kind of wizard to get all the way down to South Texas."
"Can you reach out to El Paso? That's where his run ended, but I know from Samuels that the kid ditched the van in Ohio. What I want to know is if it was somewhere near a pub and cafe called Tommy and Tuppence on Northwoods Boulevard in Dayton."
"I could take a shot at that, I guess."
"Samuels told me this Merlin the Magician was on the road a long time. Can you also try to find out when he ditched the van? If maybe it was in April?"
"I can try to do that, too. Do you want to tell me why?"
Terry Maitland was in Dayton in April, visiting his father.
Really?
Yoon sounded totally engaged now.
Alone?
With his family, Ralph admitted, and they flew both ways.
So there goes that.
Probably, but it still exercises a certain particular fascination over my consciousness.
You'll have to explain that, detective, for I am just the son of a poor Mexican farmer.
Ralph sighed.
Let me see what I can find out.
Thanks, Yoon. Just as he hung up, Chief Geller came in, toting a gym bag and looking freshly showered. Ralph tipped him a wave and got a scowl in return.
You're not supposed to be here, detective.
Ah, so that answered that question.
Go home. Mow the lawn or something.
I already did that, Ralph said, getting up. Cleaning out the cellar comes next.
Fine. Better get to it.
Geller paused at his office door.
And Ralph, I'm sorry about all this. Sorry as hell.
People keep saying that, Ralph thought as he went out into the afternoon heat. 9. Yoon called at 9:15 that evening while Jeannie was in the shower. Ralph wrote everything down. It wasn't much, but enough to be interesting. He went to bed an hour later and fell into real sleep for the first time since Terry had been shot at the foot of the courthouse steps. He awoke at 4 on Friday morning from a dream of the teenage girl sitting on her boyfriend's shoulders and pumping her fists at the sky. He sat bolt upright in bed, still more asleep than awake, and unaware he was shouting until his frightened wife sat up beside him and grabbed him by the shoulders. What, Ralph, what? Not the strap. The color of the strap. What are you talking about? She shook him. Was it a dream, honey? A bad dream? I believe there's another dozen thoughts in my head lined up behind each one I'm aware of. That was what she had said, and that was what the dream, already dissolving as dreams do, had been. One of those thoughts. I had it, he said. In the dream, I had it. Had what, honey? Something about Terry? About the girl. Her bra strap was bright yellow. Only something else was, too. I knew what it was in the dream, but now... He swung his feet out of bed and sat with his hands grasping his knees below the baggy boxers he slept in. It's gone. It will come back. Lie down. You scared the hell out of me. I'm sorry. Ralph lay down again. Can you go back to sleep? I don't know. What did Lieutenant Sablo say when he called? I didn't tell you, knowing he hadn't. No, and I didn't want to push. You had your think face on. I'll tell you in the morning. Since you scared me wide awake, might as well do it now. Not much to tell. Yoon tracked the boy down through the officer who arrested him. The cop liked the kid, kind of took an interest, has been keeping track. For the time being, young Mr. Cassidy is in the foster care system down there in El Paso. He's got to face some kind of hearing in juvenile court for car theft, but nobody knows exactly where that will be yet. Dutchess County in New York seems most likely, but they're not exactly chomping at the bit to get him, and he's not chomping at the bit to go back. So for the time being, he's in a kind of legal limbo, and according to Yoon, he likes that fine. Stepfather tuned up on him pretty frequently, is the kid's story, while Mom pretended it wasn't happening. Pretty standard cycle of abuse. Poor kid. No wonder he ran away. What will happen to him? Oh, eventually he'll be sent back. The wheels of justice grind slow but exceedingly fine. He'll get a suspended sentence, or maybe they'll work out something about time served while in foster care. The cops in his town will be alerted to his home situation, but eventually the whole thing will start up again. Kid beaters sometimes hit pause, but they rarely hit stop. He put his hands behind his head and thought of Terry, who had shown no previous signs of violence, not so much as bumping an umpire. The kid was in Dayton, all right, Ralph said, and by then he was getting nervous about the van. He parked in a public lot because it was free, because there was no attendant, and because he saw the Golden Arches a few blocks up. He doesn't remember passing the Tommy and Tuppence Cafe, but he does remember a young guy in a shirt that said Tommy something or other on the back. The guy had a stack of blue papers that he was putting under the windshield wipers of cars parked at the curb. He noticed the kid, Merlin, and offered him $2 to put menus under the wipers of the vehicles in the parking lot. The kid said no thanks and went on up to Mickey D's to get his lunch. When he came back, the leaflet guy was gone, but there were menus on every car and truck in the lot. The kid was skittish, took it as a bad omen for some reason, God knows why. Anyway, he decided the time had come to switch rides.
If he hadn't been skittish, he probably would have been caught a lot sooner, Jeannie observed.
You're right. Anyway, he strolled around the lot, checking for cars that were unlocked. He told Yoon he was surprised at how many were.
I bet you weren't.
Ralph smiled. People are careless. Fifth or sixth one he found unlocked. There was a spare key tucked behind the sun visor. It was perfect for him. A plain black Toyota. Thousands of them on the road every day. Before our boy Merlin headed out in it, though, he put the van's key back in the ignition. He told Yoon he hoped someone else would steal it because, and I quote, it might throw the popo off my trail. You know, like he was wanted for murder in six states instead of just being a runaway kid who never forgot to use his turn signal.
He said that? She sounded amused.
Yes. And by the way, he had to go back to the van for something else. A stack of smashed-down cartons he was sitting on to make him look taller behind the wheel.
I kind of like this kid. Derek never would have thought of that.
We've never given him reason to, Ralph thought.
Do you know if he left the menu under the van's windshield wiper?
Yoon asked, and the kid said sure he did. Why would he take it?
So the person who tore it off and left the scrap which ended up inside was the person who stole it from the parking lot in Dayton?
Almost had to be. Now, here's what had me wearing my think face. The kid said he thought it was in April. I take that with a grain of salt because I doubt if keeping track of dates was very important to him, but he told Yoon it was spring with all the leaves pretty much out on the trees and not real hot yet. So it probably was. And April is when Terry was in Dayton visiting his father.
Only he was with his family and they flew round trip.
I know that. You could call it a coincidence. Only then the same van ends up here in Flint City. And it's hard for me to believe in two coincidences involving the same Ford Econoline van. Yoon floated the idea that maybe Terry had an accomplice.
One who looked exactly like him.
Jeannie hoisted an eyebrow.
A twin brother named William Wilson, maybe?
I know, the idea is ridiculous. But you see how weird it is, don't you? Terry is in Dayton. The van is in Dayton. Terry comes home to Flint City, and the van turns up in Flint City. There's a word for that, but I can't remember what it is.
Confluence might be the one you're looking for.
I want to talk to Marcy, he said. I want to ask her about the trip the Maitlands made to Dayton. Everything she remembers. Only she won't want to talk to me, and I have absolutely no way of compelling her.
Will you try?
Oh, yes, I'll try.
Can you sleep now?
I think so. Love you.
Love you, too.
He was drifting away when she spoke into his ear, firm and almost harsh, trying to shock it out of him. If it wasn't the bra strap, what was it? For a moment, clearly, Ralph saw the word can't. Only the letters were bluey-green, not yellow. Something was there. He grasped for it, but it slipped away. Can't, he said.
Not yet, Jeannie replied. But you will. I know you.
They went to sleep. When Ralph woke up, it was 8 o'clock, and all the birds were singing. 10. By 10 on that Friday morning, Sarah and Grace had reached the Hard Day's Night album, and Marcy thought she might actually lose her mind. The girls had found Terry's record player, a steal on eBay, he had assured Marcy, in his garage workshop, along with his carefully assembled collection of Beatles albums. They had taken the player and the albums up to Grace's room and had begun with Meet the Beatles. We're going to play all of them, Sarah told her mother, to remember Daddy, if it's okay. Marcy told them it was fine. What else could she say when looking at their pale, solemn faces and red-rimmed eyes? Only she hadn't realized how hard those songs would hit her. The girls knew them all, of course. When Terry was in the garage, the record player's turntable was always spinning, filling his workshop with the British invasion groups he'd been born a little too late to have heard firsthand, but which he loved just the same. The Searchers, the Zombies, the Dave Clark Five, the Kinks, T-Rex, and, of course, the Beatles. Mostly them. The girls loved those groups and those songs because their father did, but there was a whole emotional spectrum of which they were unaware. They hadn't heard I Call Your Name while making out in the back of Terry's father's car, Terry's lips on her neck, Terry's hand under her sweater. They hadn't heard Can't Buy Me Love, the current track coming down from upstairs, while sitting on the couch in the first apartment where they'd lived together, holding hands, watching A Hard Day's Night on the battered VHS they'd picked up at a rummage sale for $20. The Fab Four young and running amok in black and white, Marcy knowing she was going to marry the young man sitting next to her, even if he didn't know it yet. Had John Lennon already been dead when they watched that old tape? Shot down in the street, just as her husband had been? She didn't know. Couldn't remember. All she knew was she, Sarah, and Grace had gotten through the funeral with their dignity intact. But now the funeral was over. Her life as a single mom, oh, that horrible phrase, stretched ahead of her, and the cheerful music was driving her mad with sorrow. Every harmonized vocal, each clever George Harrison riff, was a fresh wound. Twice she had gotten up from where she sat at the kitchen table with a cooling cup of coffee in front of her. Twice she had gone to the foot of the stairs and drawn in breath to shout, "No more! Shut it off!" And twice she had gone back to the kitchen. They were grieving too. This time when she got up, Marcy went to the utensil drawer and pulled it all the way out. She thought there would be nothing there, but her hand found a pack of Winston cigarettes. There were three left inside. No, make that four. One was hiding all the way in back. She hadn't smoked since her younger daughter's fifth birthday, when she'd had a coughing fit while mixing the batter for Gracie's cake and had vowed there and then to quit forever. Yet, instead of throwing these last soldiers of cancer out, she had tossed them in back of the utensil drawer, as if some dark and prescient part of her had known she would eventually need them again. They're 5 years old. They'll be stale as hell. You'll probably cough until you pass out. Good. So much the better. She took one from the pack, greedy for it already. Smokers never stop, they only pause, she thought. She went to the stairs and cocked her head. And I Love Her had given way to Tell Me Why, that eternal question. She could imagine the girls sitting on Grace's bed, not talking, just listening, holding hands, maybe, taking the sacrament of Daddy. Daddy's albums, some bought at Turn Back the Hands of Time, the record store in Cap City, some bought online, all held in the hands that had once held his daughters. She crossed the living room to the little pot-bellied stove they lit only on really cold winter nights and reached blindly for the box of diamond matches on the nearby shelf, blindly because on that shelf also stood a row of pictures she could not currently bear to look at. Maybe in a month she could. Maybe in a year. How long did it take to recover from the first, rawest stage of grief? She could probably find a fairly definitive answer on WebMD, but was afraid to look. At least the reporters had gone away after the funeral, rushing back to Cap City to cover some fresh political scandal, and she wouldn't have to risk the back porch where one of the girls might look out the window and see her renewing her old vice, or in the garage where they might smell the smoke if they came out for a fresh bundle of LPs. She opened the front door, and there stood Ralph Anderson with his fist raised to knock. 11. The horror with which she stared at him, as if he were some kind of monster, maybe a zombie from that TV show, struck Ralph like a blow to the chest. He had time to see the disarray of her hair, a splotch of something on the lapel of her robe, which was too big for her, maybe it was Terry's, the slightly bent cigarette between her fingers, and something else. She'd always been a fine-looking woman, but she was losing her looks already. He would have called that impossible. Marcy?
No, you don't belong here. You need to get out of here.
Her voice was low, breathless, as if someone had punched her.
I need to talk to you. Please let me talk to you.
You killed my husband. There's nothing else to say.
She started to swing the door closed. Ralph held it with his hand.
I didn't kill him, but yes, I played a part. Call me an accomplice if that's what you want. I never should have arrested him the way I did. It was wrong on God knows how many different levels. I had my reasons, but they weren't good reasons.
Take your hand off the door. Do it now, or I'll have you arrested.
Marcy?
Don't call me that! You have no right to call me that, not after what you did. The only reason I'm not screaming my head off is because my daughters are upstairs, listening to their dead father's records.
Please, he thought to say, don't make me beg, but that was wrong because it wasn't enough. I'm begging you. Please talk to me.
She held up the cigarette and uttered a terrible, toneless laugh.
I thought, now the little lice are gone, I can have a smoke on my doorstep.
And look, here's the big louse. The louse of louses.
Last warning, Mr. Louse, who got my husband killed. Get the fuck off my doorstep.
What if he didn't do it?
Her eyes widened, and the pressure of her hand on the door slackened, at least for the moment. What if he... Jesus Christ, he told you he didn't do it. He told you as he lay there dying. What else do you want? A hand-delivered telegram from the angel Gabriel?
If he didn't, whoever did is still out there, and he's responsible for the destruction of the Peterson family as well as yours.
She considered this for a moment, then said, Oliver Peterson is dead because you and that son of a bitch Samuels had to put on your circus. And you killed him, didn't you, Detective Anderson? Shot him in the head. Got your man. Excuse me, your boy.
She slammed the door in his face. Ralph again raised his hand to knock, thought better of it, and turned away.
12. Marcy stood trembling on her side of the door. She felt her knees go loose and managed to make it to the bench near the door where people sat when they took off boots or muddy shoes. Upstairs, the beetle who had been murdered was singing about all the things he was going to do when he got home. Marcy looked at the cigarette between her fingers as if unsure how it had gotten there, then snapped it in two and slipped the pieces into the pocket of the robe she was wearing. It was indeed Terry's.
At least he saved me from starting up that shit again, she thought. Maybe I should write him a thank you note.
The nerve of him, coming to her door after taking a wrecking bar to her family and flailing around with it until all was in ruins. The pure, cruel, in-your-face nerve of it! Only, if he didn't, whoever did is still out there.
And how was she supposed to handle that when she couldn't even find the strength to go on WebMD and find out how long the first stage of grief lasted? And why was she supposed to do anything? How was it her responsibility?
The police had gotten the wrong man and stubbornly persisted even after checking Terry's alibi and finding it as solid as Gibraltar. Let them find the right one, if they had the guts to do so.
Her job was to get through today without going insane. And then, in some future that was hard to contemplate, figure out what came next in her life. Was she supposed to live here, when half the town believed the man who had assassinated her husband was doing God's work? Was she supposed to condemn her daughters to those cannibal societies known as middle school and high school, where even wearing the wrong sneakers could get you ridiculed and ostracized?
Sending Anderson away was the right thing. I cannot have him in my house. Yes, I heard the honesty in his voice. At least I think I did. But how can I, after what he did?
If he didn't, whoever did.
Shut up,
she whispered to herself.
Just shut up, please, shut up.
He's still out there.
And what if he did it again?
13. Most of the folks in Flint City's better class of citizenry thought Howard Gold had been born rich, or at least well-to-do. Although he wasn't ashamed of his catch-as-catch-can upbringing, not a bit, he didn't go out of his way to disabuse those folks. It so happened he was the son of an itinerant plowboy, sometime wrangler, and occasional rodeo rider, who had traveled around the Southwest in an Airstream trailer with his wife and two sons, Howard and Edward. Howard had put himself through college, then helped to do the same for Eddie. He took care of his parents in their retirement. Andrew Gold had saved nary a nickel, and had plenty left over. He was a member of Rotary and the Rolling Hills Country Club. He took important clients to dinner at Flint City's best restaurants, there were two, and supported a dozen different charities, including the athletic fields at Estelle Barga Park. He could order fine wine with the best of them, and sent his biggest clients elaborate Harry and David gift boxes each Christmas. Yet when he was in his office, by himself, as he was this Friday noon, he preferred to eat as he had as a boy on the road between Hoot, Oklahoma, and Holler, Nevada, and then back again, listening to Clint Black on the radio and studying his lessons at his mother's side when he wasn't in school someplace. He supposed his gallbladder would put a stop to his solitary, grease-soaked meals eventually, but he had reached his early 60s without hearing a peep from it, so God bless heredity. When the phone rang, he was working his way through a fried egg sandwich, heavy on the mayo, and French fries done just the way he liked them, cooked to a blackened crisp and slathered with ketchup. Waiting at the edge of the desk was a slice of apple pie with ice cream melting on top. Howard Gold speaking.
It's Marcy, Howie. Ralph Anderson was here this morning.
Howie frowned. He came to your house? He's got no business doing that. He's on administrative leave. Won't be active police again for some time, assuming he decides to come back at all. Did you want me to call Chief Geller and put a bug in his ear?
No. I slammed the door in his face.
Good for you.
It doesn't feel good. He said something I can't get out of my mind. Howard, tell me the truth. Do you think Terry killed that boy?
Jesus, no. I told you. There's evidence for it, we both know that, but there's too much against it. He would have walked, but never mind that, he just didn't have such an act in him. Also, there was his dying declaration.
People will say that was because he didn't want to admit it in front of me. They're probably already saying it.
Honey, he thought, I'm not sure he even knew you were there. I think he was telling the truth.
So do I. And if he was, whoever did it is still free. And if he killed one child, sooner or later he'll kill another one.
So that's what Anderson put in your mind, Howie said. He pushed away what remained of his sandwich. He no longer wanted it.
I'm not surprised. The guilt trip is an old police trick, but he was wrong to try it on you. Ralph needs to take some heat for it. A strong reprimand that goes in his jacket at the very least. You just buried your husband, for God's sake.
But what he said was true. Maybe it was, Howie thought. But that begs the question, why did he say it to you? And there's something else, she said. If the real killer isn't found, the girls and I will have to leave town. Maybe I could stand up to the whispers and the gossip if I was on my own, but it isn't fair to ask the girls to do that. The only place I can think of to go to is my sister's in Michigan, and that wouldn't be fair to Deborah and Sam. They've got two kids of their own, and the house is small. It would mean starting all over again for me, and I feel too tired to do that. I feel... Howie, I feel broken.
I understand that. What is it you want me to do?
Call Anderson. Tell him I'll meet with him here at the house tonight, and he can ask his questions. But I want you here, too. You and the investigator you use, if he's free and willing to come. Will you do that?
Of course, if it's what you want. And I'm sure Alec would come. But I want to not warn you, exactly, but put you on your guard. I'm sure Ralph feels terrible about what happened, and I'm guessing he apologized.
He said he was begging me.
That was sort of amazing, but maybe not entirely out of character. He's not a bad man, Howie said. He's a good man who made a bad mistake. But Marcy still got a vested interest in proving it was Terry who killed the Peterson boy. If he can do that, his career is back on track. If it's never proved conclusively one way or the other, his career is still back on track. But if the real killer turns up, Ralph is finished as a member of the FC police. His next job will be working security in Cap City at half the salary, and that's not even figuring in the suits he might be facing.
I understand that, but
I'm not finished. Any questions he's got for you have to be about Terry. Maybe he's just flailing around, but it's possible he thinks he's got something that ties Terry to the murder in a different way. Now, do you still want me to set up a meeting? There was silence for a moment, and then Marcy said,
Jamie Mattingly is my best friend on Barnum Court. She took the girls in after Terry was arrested at the ball field, but now she won't answer her phone when I call, and she's unfriended me on Facebook. My best friend has officially unfriended me.
She'll come around.
She will, if the real killer is caught. And she'll come to me on her hands and knees. Maybe I'll forgive her for knuckling under to her husband, because that's what happened, count on it. And maybe I won't. But that's a decision I can't make until things change for the better, if they ever do. Which is my way of saying, go ahead and set up the meeting. You'll be there to protect me. Mr. Pelly, too. I want to know why Anderson got up enough guts to show his face at my door.
14. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, an old Dodge pickup rattled along a ranch road 15 miles south of Flint City, pulling up a rooster tail of dust. It passed an abandoned windmill with broken vanes, a deserted ranch house with glaring holes where the windows had been, a long abandoned cemetery locally known as the Cowboy Graveyard, a boulder with Trump Make America Great Again Trump painted on the side in fading letters. Galvanized milk cans rolled around in the truck bed and banged off the sides. Behind the wheel was a 17-year-old boy named Dougie Elfman. He kept checking his cell phone as he drove. By the time he got to Highway 79, he had 2 bars and reckoned that would be enough. He stopped at the crossing, got out, and looked behind him. Nothing. Of course there was nothing. And still, he was relieved. He called his daddy. Clark Elfman answered on the second ring.
Were those cans out there in that barn?
Yeah, Dougie said. I got 2 dozen, but they'll have to be washed out. Still smell like clabbered milk.
What about the hoss tack?
All gone, Daddy.
Well, that ain't the best news of the week, but no more than what I expected. What you calling for, son, and where are you? Sound like you're on the dark side of the moon.
I'm out at 79. Listen, Daddy, somebody been staying out there.
What? You mean like hobos or hippies?
It ain't that. There's no mess. Beer cans or wrappers or liquor bottles. And no sign anyone took a dump anywhere unless they walked a quarter of a mile to the nearest bushes. No campfire sign either.
Thank Christ for that, Elfman said. Dry as it's been. What did you find? Not that I guess it matters. Nothing left to steal, and them old buildings have fallen down not worth pea turkey.
Dougie kept looking back. The road looked empty, all right, but he wished the dust would settle faster.
I found a pair of blue jeans that looked new, and jockey underpants that looked new, and some expensive sneakers, them with the gel insides, that also looked new. Only they're all stained with something, and so's the hay they was lying in.
Blood?
No, it ain't blood. Turned the hay black, whatever it was.
All? Motor all? Something like that?
No, the stuff wasn't black. Just the hay it got on. I don't know what it was.
But he knew what those stiff patches on the jeans and underpants looked like. He had been masturbating 3 and sometimes 4 times a day since he turned 14, using an old piece of towel to shoot his spunk into, and then using the backyard tap to rinse it out when his parents were gone. Sometimes he forgot, though, and that piece of toweling got pretty crusty. Only there had been a lot of that stuff. A lot. Really, who would jizz off on a brand new pair of Addy Powers? High-class kicks that cost upward of $140, even at Wally World.
Dougie might have thought about taking them for himself under other circumstances, but not with that crap on them, and not with the other thing he'd noticed.
Well, let it go and just come on home, Elfman said. You got those cans, at least.
No, Daddy. You need to get the police out. There was a belt in them jeans, and it's got a shiny silver buckle in the shape of a horse's head.
That means nothing to me, son, but I guess it does to you.
On the news, they said that Terry Maitland was wearing a buckle like that when he was seen at the train station in Dubrow, after he killed that little boy.
They said that?
Yes, Daddy.
Well, shit. You wait there at the crossing until I call you back. But I guess the cops will want to come. I'll come, too.
Tell them I'll meet them at Biddle's store.
Biddle's? Dougie, that's 5 miles back toward Flint.
I know, but I don't want to stay here.
The dust had settled now, and there was nothing to be seen. But Dougie still didn't feel right. Not a single car had passed on the main road since he started talking to his father, and he wanted to be where there were people.
What's wrong, son?
When I was in that barn where I found the clothes, I'd already got the cans by then and was looking for that tack you said might be out there. I started to feel all wrong, like someone was watching me.
You just got the creeps. The man who killed that boy is dead as dirt.
I know, but tell the cops I'll meet him at Biddle's, and I'll take him out there, but I'm not staying here by myself.
He ended the call before his father could argue with him. 15. The meeting with Marcy was set for 8 o'clock that night at the Maitland home. Ralph got the green light call from Howie Gold, who told him Alec Pelley would also be there. Ralph asked if he could bring Ewan Sablo, if Ewan was available.
Under no circumstances, Howie replied. Bring Lieutenant Sablo or anyone else, even your lovely wife, and the meeting's off.
Ralph agreed. There was nothing else he could do. He puttered around in the cellar for a while, mostly just shifting boxes from one side to the other and back again. Then he picked at his supper. With 2 hours still stretching before him, he pushed away from the table. I'm going to the hospital to visit Fred Peterson.
Why?
I just feel like I should.
I'll come with you if you want.
Ralph shook his head. I'll go directly to Barnum Court from there.
You're wearing yourself out, running your guts to water, my grandmother would have said.
I'm okay. She gave him a smile that said she knew better, then stood on her toes to kiss him.
Call me. Whatever happens, call me.
He smiled. Nuts to that. I'll come back and tell you in person.
16. As he was entering the hospital's lobby, Ralph met the department's missing detective on his way out. Jack Hoskins was a slight man, prematurely gray, with bags under his eyes and a red-veined nose. He was still wearing his fishing outfit, khaki shirt and khaki pants, both with many pockets, but his badge was clipped to his belt.
What are you doing here, Jack? I thought you were on vacation.
Called back 3 days early, he said. Drove into town not an hour ago. My net, gum rubbers, poles, and tackle box are still in my truck. Chief thought he might like to have at least one detective on active duty. Betsy Riggins is upstairs on 5, having the baby. Her labor started late this afternoon. I talked to her husband, who says she's got a long way to go, like he'd have any idea. As for you, he paused for effect, you're in a hell of a mess, Ralph.
Jack Hoskins made no effort to hide his satisfaction. A year previous, Ralph and Betsy Riggins had been asked to fill out routine evaluation forms for Jack when he became eligible for a pay bump. Betsy, the detective with the least seniority, had said all the right things. Ralph had turned his in to Chief Geller with only 2 words written in the space provided: no opinion. It hadn't kept Hoskins from getting his bump, but it was an opinion all the same. Hoskins wasn't supposed to see the eval sheets and maybe hadn't, but word of what had been on Ralph's had, of course, gotten back to him.
Did you look in on Fred Peterson?
As a matter of fact, I did.
Jack pursed his lower lip and blew scant hair off his forehead.
Lots of monitors in his room and low lines on all of them. I don't think he's coming back.
Well, welcome home.
Fuck that, Ralph. I had 3 more days. The baths were running, and I'm not even going to get a chance to change my shirt, which stinks of fish guts. Got calls from both Geller and Sheriff Doolin. Have to go all the way out to that useless dust bowl known as Canning Township. I understand your buddy Sablo's already there. I probably won't actually make it home until 10 or 11.
Ralph could have said, don't blame me, but who else was this mostly useless time server going to blame? Betsy, for getting pregnant last November? What's in Canning?
Jeans, underpants, and sneakers. Kid found them in a shed or barn while he was hunting out milk cans for his father. Also a belt with a horse's head buckle. Of course, the mobile crime lab will already be there. I'll be about as useful as tits on a bull. But the chief...
There'll be fingerprints on the buckle, Ralph interrupted. And there may be tire tracks from the van or the Subaru or both.
Don't try teaching your daddy how to suck eggs, Jack said. I was carrying a detective shield while you were still in uniform.
The subtext Ralph heard was, and I'll still be carrying it when you're working as a mall guard at Southgate. He left. Ralph was glad to see him go. He only wished he could go out there himself. Fresh evidence at this point could be precious. The silver lining was that Sablo had already gotten there and would be supervising the forensics unit. They'd finished most of their work before Jack could arrive and maybe screw something up, as he had on at least 2 previous occasions that Ralph knew about. He went up to the maternity waiting room first, but all the seats were empty, so maybe the delivery was going faster than Billy Riggins, a nervous novice at this, had expected. Ralph buttonholed the nurse and asked her to tell Betsy that he wished her all the best.
I will when I get the chance, the nurse said, but right now she's very busy. That little man is in a hurry to get out.
Ralph had a brief image of Frank Peterson's bloody, violated body and thought, if the little man knew what this world was like, he'd be fighting to stay in. He took the elevator down 2 floors to ICU. The remaining member of the Peterson family was in room 304.
His neck was heavily bandaged and in a cervical collar. A respirator wheezed, the little accordion gadget inside flopping up and down. The lines on the monitors surrounding the man's bed were, as Jack Hoskins had said, mighty low. There were no flowers. Ralph had an idea they weren't allowed in ICU rooms. But a couple of Mylar balloons had been tethered to the foot of the bed and floated near the ceiling. They were imprinted with cheerful exhortations Ralph didn't like to look at. He listened to the wheeze of the machine that was breathing for Fred. He stared at those low lines and thought of Jack saying, "I don't think he's coming back." As he sat down by the bed, a memory from his high school days came to him. Back when what was now called environmental studies had been plain old earth science. They had been studying pollution. Mr. Greer had produced a bottle of Poland spring water and poured it into a glass. He invited one of the kids, Misty Trenton it had been, she of the deliciously short skirts, up to the front of the room and asked her to take a sip. She had done so. Mr. Greer then produced an eyedropper and dipped it into a bottle of Carter's ink. He squeezed a drop into the glass. The students watched, fascinated, as that single drop sank, trailing an indigo tentacle behind it. Mr. Greer rocked the glass gently from side to side, and soon all the water in the glass was tinted a weak blue. "Would you drink it now?" Mr. Greer asked Misty. She shook her head so emphatically that one of her hair clips came loose, and everybody, Ralph included, had laughed. He wasn't laughing now. Less than 2 weeks ago, the Peterson family had been perfectly fine. Then had come the drop of polluting ink. You could say it was the chain on Frankie Peterson's bike that he would have made at home unharmed if it hadn't broken. But he also would have made it home unharmed, only pushing his bike instead of riding it, if Terry Maitland hadn't been waiting in that grocery store parking lot. Terry was the drop of ink, not the bike chain. It was Terry who had first polluted and then destroyed the entire Peterson family. Terry, or whoever had been wearing Terry's face. "Strip away the metaphors," Jeannie had said, "and you are left with the inexplicable, the supernatural." Only that's not possible. The supernatural may exist in books and movies, but not in the real world. No, not in the real world, where drunk incompetence like Jack Hoskins got pay bumps. All Ralph had experienced in his nearly 50 years of life denied the idea, denied there was even the possibility of such a thing. Yet as he sat here looking at Fred, or what remained of him, Ralph had to admit there was something devilish about the way the boy's death had spread, taking not just one or two members of his nuclear family, but the whole shebang. Nor did the damage stop with the Petersons. No one could doubt that Marcy and her daughters would carry scars for the rest of their lives, perhaps even permanent disabilities. Ralph could tell himself that similar collateral damage followed every atrocity. Hadn't he seen it time and again? Yes, he had. Yet this one seemed so personal, somehow. Almost as if these people had been targeted. And what about Ralph himself? Was he not part of the collateral damage? And Jeannie, even Derek, who was going to come home from camp to discover that a good many things he'd taken for granted, his father's job, for instance, were now at risk. The respirator wheezed. Fred Peterson's chest rose and fell. Every now and then he made a thick noise that sounded weirdly like a chuckle, as if it were all a cosmic joke, but you had to be in a coma to get it. Ralph couldn't stand it anymore. He left the room, and by the time he got to the elevator, he was nearly running. 17. Once outside, he sat on a bench in the shade and called the station. Sandy McGill picked up, and when Ralph asked if she'd heard anything from Canning Township, there was a pause. When she finally spoke, she sounded embarrassed.
"I'm not supposed to talk about that with you, Ralph.
Chief Geller left specific instructions. I'm sorry.
That's okay, Ralph said, getting up. His shadow stretched long, the shadow of a hanged man, and, of course, that made him think of Fred Peterson again.
Orders is orders.
Thanks for understanding. Jack Hoskins is back, and he's going out there.
No problem.
He hung up and started for the short-term parking lot, telling himself it didn't matter. Yoon would keep him in the loop. Probably. He unlocked his car, got in, and cranked the air conditioning. 7:15. Too late to go home, too early to go to the Maitlands, which left cruising aimlessly around town like a self-absorbed teenager and thinking about how Terry had called Willow Rainwater ma'am, about how Terry had asked directions to the nearest dock in the box, even though he'd lived in FC all his life, about how Terry had shared a room with Billy Quaid and wasn't that convenient, about how Terry had risen to his feet to ask Mr. Coben his question, which was even more convenient, thinking about that drop of ink in the glass of water, turning it pale blue, of footprints that just ended, of maggots squirming inside a cantaloupe that had looked fine on the outside, thinking that if a person did begin considering supernatural possibilities, that person would no longer be able to think of himself as a completely sane person, and thinking about one's sanity was maybe not a good thing. It was like thinking about your heartbeat. If you had to go there, you might already be in trouble. He turned on the car radio and hunted for loud music. Eventually he found the animals belting out boom boom. He cruised, waiting for it to be time to go to the Maitland house on Barnum Court. Finally it was. 18. It was Alec Pelley who answered his knock and led him across the living room and into the kitchen. From upstairs he could hear the animals again. This time it was their biggest hit. It's been the ruin of many a poor boy, Eric Burden wailed, and God, I know I'm one. Confluence, he thought. Jeannie's word. Marcy and Howie Gold were sitting at the kitchen table. They had coffee. There was also a cup where Alec had been sitting, but no one offered to pour Ralph a cup. I have come into the camp of mine enemies, he thought, and sat down. Thank you for seeing me. Marcy made no reply, just picked up her cup with a hand that wasn't quite steady. This is painful for my client, Howie said, so let's keep it brief. You told Marcy you wanted to talk to her.
Needed, Marcy interrupted. Needed to talk to me is what he said.
So noted. What is it you needed to talk to her about, Detective Anderson? If it's an apology, feel free to make it, but understand that we reserve all our legal options.
In spite of everything, Ralph wasn't quite ready to apologize. None of these three had seen a bloody branch jutting from Frank Peterson's bottom, but Ralph had.
New information has come to light. It may not be substantive, but it's suggestive of something, although I don't know exactly what. My wife called it a confluence.
Could you be a little more specific? Howie asked. It turns out that the van used to abduct the Peterson boy was stolen by a kid only a little older than Frank Peterson himself. The kid's name is Merlin Cassidy. He was running away from an abusive stepfather. In the course of his run between New York and South Texas, where he was finally arrested, he stole a number of vehicles. He dumped the van in Dayton, Ohio, in April. Marcy, Mrs. Maitland, you and your family were in Dayton in April.
Marcy had been raising her cup for another sip, but now she set it down with a bang.
Oh, no, you're not putting that on Terry. We flew both ways, and except for when Terry went to visit his dad, we were together the whole time. End of story, and I think it's time for you to leave.
Whoa, Ralph said. We knew it was a family trip and that you went by air almost from the time Terry became a person of interest. It's just that, can't you see how weird it is?
The van is there when your family is there. Then it turns up here. Terry told me he never saw it, let alone stole it. I want to believe that. We have his fingerprints all over the damn thing, but I still want to, and almost can.
I doubt it, Howie said. Stop trying to suck us in.
Would it help you to believe me, maybe even trust me a little, if I told you we now have physical evidence that Terry was in Cap City? His fingerprints on a book from the hotel newsstand? Testimony that has him leaving those prints at approximately the same time the Peterson boy was abducted?
Are you kidding?
Alec Pelley asked. He sounded almost shocked. No. Even with the case as effectively dead as Terry himself, Bill Samuels would be furious if he found out Ralph had told Marcy and Marcy's lawyer about a pictorial history of Flint County, Dury County, and Canning Township. But he was determined not to let this meeting end without getting some answers. Alec whistled.
Holy shit!
So you know he was there! Marcy cried. Red spots were burning in her cheeks. You have to know it! But Ralph didn't want to go there. He had spent too much time there already. Terry mentioned the Dayton trip the last time I talked to him. He said he wanted to visit his father, but he said wanted with a funny kind of grimace. And when I asked him if his dad lived there, he said, if you can call what he's doing these days living. So what's the deal with that?
The deal is Peter Maitland is suffering from advanced Alzheimer's disease, Marcy said. He's in the Heisman Memory Unit. It's part of the Kindred Hospital complex.
So, tough for Terry to go see him, I guess.
Very tough, Marcy agreed. She was warming up a little now. Ralph was glad to discover he hadn't lost all of his skills, but this wasn't like being in an interrogation room with a suspect.
Both Howie and Alec Pelley were on high alert, ready to stop her if they sensed her foot coming down on a hidden mine.
But not just because Peter didn't know Terry any longer. They hadn't had much of a relationship for a long time.
Why not?
How is this relevant, Detective? Howie asked.
I don't know. Maybe it's not. But since we're not in court, Counselor, how about you let her answer the damn question? Howie looked at Marcy and shrugged. Up to you.
Terry was Peter and Melinda's only child, Marcy said. He grew up here in Flint City, as you know, and lived here all his life, except for 4 years at OSU.
Where you met him? Ralph asked.
That's right. Anyway, Peter Maitland worked for the Cheery Petroleum Company back in the days when this area was still producing a fair amount of oil. He fell in love with his secretary and divorced his wife. There was a lot of rancor, and Terry took his mother's side. Terry, he was all about loyalty, even as a boy. He saw his father as a cheat, which he was, of course, and all of Peter's justifications only made things worse. Long story short, Peter married the secretary, Dolores was her name, and asked for a transfer to the company headquarters,
which were in Dayton.
Correct. Peter didn't try for joint custody or anything like that. He understood Terry had made his choice. But Melinda insisted that Terry go to see him from time to time, claiming that a boy needed to know his father. Terry went, but only to please his mom. He never stopped seeing his father as the rat who ran away.
Howie said, "That fits the Terry I knew."
Melinda died in 2006, heart attack. Peter's second wife died 2 years later of lung cancer. Terry kept on going to Dayton once or twice a year to honor his mother and kept on reasonably civil terms with his father, for the same reason, I suppose. In 2011, I think it was, Peter began to get forgetful. Shoes in the shower instead of under the bed, car keys in the refrigerator, stuff like that. Because Terry was his only close living relative, it was Terry who arranged to get him into the Heisman Memory Unit. That was in 2014.
Places like that are expensive, Alec said. Who pays?
Insurance, Peter Maitland had very good insurance, Dolores insisted. Peter was a heavy smoker all his life, and she probably thought she'd inherit a bundle when he went. But she went first, probably from his second-hand smoke.
"You speak as if Peter Maitland is dead," Ralph said. "Is that the case?"
"No, he's still alive."
Then, in a deliberate echo of her husband,
"If you want to call that living. He's even stopped smoking. It's not allowed in the HMU."
"How long were you in Dayton on your last visit?"
5 days. Terry visited his father 3 times while we were there.
"You and the girls never went with him?"
"No. Terry didn't want that, and neither did I. It wasn't as if Peter could have been grandfatherly to Sarah and Grace wouldn't have understood."
"What did you do while he was visiting?"
Marcy smiled. "You speak as though Terry spent huge wallops of time with his father, and that wasn't the case. His visits were short, no more than an hour or two. Mostly the four of us were together. When Terry was at the Heisman, we hung out at the hotel and the girls swam in the indoor pool. One day, the three of us went to the Art Institute, and one afternoon I took the girls to a Disney matinee. There was a cinema complex close to the hotel. We hit 2 or maybe 3 other movies, but that was the whole family. We went to the Air Force Museum as a family, and to the Bunshoft, which is a science museum. The girls loved that. It was your basic family vacation, Detective Anderson, with Terry taking a few hours away to do his filial duty.
And maybe to steal a van, Ralph thought. It was possible. Merlin Cassidy and the Maitland family certainly could have been in Dayton at the same time, but it seemed far-fetched. Even if that had happened, there was the question of how Terry had gotten the van back to Flint City, or why he would have bothered. There were plenty of vehicles to be stolen in the FC metro area. Barbara Nearing's Subaru was a case in point. "Probably ate out a few times, didn't you?" Ralph asked. Howie sat forward at that, but said nothing for the moment.
"We had a fair amount of room service. Sarah and Grace loved it. But sure, we ate out, assuming the hotel restaurant counts as out."
"Did you happen to eat at a place called Tommy and Tuppence?"
"No. I'd remember a restaurant with a name like that. We ate at IHOP one night, and I think twice at Cracker Barrel. Why?"
"No reason," Ralph said. Howie gave him a smile that said he knew better, but settled back. Alex sat with his arms crossed over his chest, his face expressionless.
"Is that everything?" Marcy asked. "Because I'm tired of this, and I'm tired of you."
"Did anything out of the ordinary happen while you were in Dayton? Anything at all? One of your daughters getting lost for a little while? Terry saying he'd met an old friend, you meeting an old friend, maybe a package delivery?"
"A flying saucer?" Howie asked. "How about a man in a trench coat with a message in code? Or the Rockettes dancing in the parking lot?"
"Not helpful, counselor. Believe it or not, I'm trying to be part of the solution here."
"There was nothing."
Marcy got up and began collecting coffee cups.
"Terry visited his father. We had a nice vacation. We flew home. We didn't eat at Tommy and whatever it was, and we didn't steal a van. Now I'd like you to..."
"Daddy got a cut." They all turned to the door. Sarah Maitland was standing there, looking pale and wan and much too thin in her jeans and Rangers t-shirt.
"Sarah, what are you doing down here?" Marcy put the cups on the counter and went to the girl. "I told you and your sister to stay upstairs until we're done talking."
"Grace is already asleep," Sarah said. "She was awake last night with more stupid nightmares about the man with straws for eyes. I hope she doesn't have any tonight. If she wakes up, you should give her a shot of Benadryl."
"I'm sure she'll sleep through. Go on now."
But Sarah stood her ground. She was looking at Ralph, not with her mother's dislike and distrust, but with a kind of concentrated curiosity that made Ralph uncomfortable. He held her gaze, but it was difficult. My mother says you got my dad killed, Sarah said. Is that true?
No. Then the apology came at last, and to his surprise it was almost effortless. But I played a part, and for that I'm deeply sorry. I made a mistake I'll carry with me for the rest of my life.
Probably that's good, Sarah said. Probably you deserve to.
And to her mother.
I'll go upstairs now, but if Grace starts yelling in the middle of the night, I'm going to sleep in her room.
Before you go, Sarah, can you tell me about the cut? Ralph asked.
It happened when he visited his father, Sarah said. A nurse fixed it up right after it happened. She put on that betadine stuff and a Band-Aid. It was okay. He said it didn't hurt.
Upstairs, you, Marcy said.
Okay. They watched her pad to the stairs in her bare feet. When she got there, she turned back. That Tommy and Tuppence restaurant was right up the street from our hotel. When we went to the art museum in the Rent-A-Dent, I saw the sign.
19. Tell me about the cut, Ralph said. Marcy put her hands on her hips.
Why? So you can make it into some kind of big deal because it wasn't?
He's asking because it's the only thing he's got, Alex said. But I'm interested, too.
If you're too tired, Howie began.
No, that's all right. It wasn't a big deal. Just a scrape, really.
Was that the second time he visited his father?
She lowered her head, frowning.
No, it was the last time, because we flew home the next morning. When Terry left his father's room, he smacked into an orderly. He said neither of them was looking where he was going. It would have been no more than bump and excuse me, but a janitor had just finished mopping the floor and it was still wet. The orderly slipped and grabbed Terry's arm but went down anyway. Terry helped him up, asked if he was all right, and the guy said he was. Terry was halfway down the hall before he saw his wrist was bleeding. One of the orderly's nails must have gotten him when he grabbed Terry trying to stay on his feet. A nurse disinfected it and put on a Band-Aid, like Sarah said. And that's the whole story. Does it solve the case for you?
No, Ralph said. But it wasn't like the yellow bra strap. This was a connection. A confluence, to use Jeannie's word. He thought he could nail down, but he would need Yoon Sablo's help. He stood up. Thanks for your time, Marcy. She favored him with a cold smile.
That's Mrs. Maitland to you.
Understood.
And Howard, thanks for setting this up.
He extended his hand to the lawyer. For a moment it just hung there, but in the end Howie shook it.
I'll walk you out, Alex said.
I think I can find my way.
I'm sure you can, but since I walked you in, it makes a nice balance.
They crossed the living room and went down the short hall. Alec opened the door. Ralph stepped out and was surprised when Alec stepped out after him.
What was it about the cut?
Ralph eyed him. I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you do. Your face changed.
A little acid indigestion, I'm prone to it, and that was a tough meeting, although not as tough as the way the girl looked at me. I felt like a bug on a slide. Alec closed the door behind him. Ralph was two steps down, but because of his height, the two men were still almost eye to eye.
Going to tell you something, Alec said.
All right, Ralph braced himself.
That arrest was fucked. Fucked to the sky. I'm sure you know that now.
I don't think I need another scolding tonight. Ralph started to turn away.
I'm not done.
Ralph turned back, head lowered, feet slightly spread. It was a fighter's stance.
I don't have any kids. Marie couldn't. But if I'd had a son your boy's age, and if I had solid proof that a homicidal sexual deviant had been important to him, someone he looked up to, I might have done the same thing or worse. What I'm saying is that I understand why you lost perspective.
All right, Ralph said.
Does make things better, but thanks. If you change your mind about telling me what it was about the cut, give me a call. Maybe we're all on the same side here. Good night, Alec. Good night, Detective. Stay safe.
20. He was telling Jeannie how it went when his phone rang. It was Yoon.
Can we talk tomorrow, Ralph? There was something weird in that barn where the kid found the clothes Maitland was wearing in the railway station. More than one thing, actually.
Tell me now.
No, I'm going home. I'm tired, and I need to think about this.
Okay, tomorrow. Where?
Someplace quiet and out of the way. I can't afford to be seen talking to you. You're on administrative leave, and I'm off the case. Actually, there is no case. Not with Maitland dead.
What's going to happen with the clothes?
They're going to Cap City for a forensic examination. After that, they'll be turned over to the Flint County Sheriff's Department.
Are you kidding? They should be with the rest of the Maitland evidence. Besides which, Dick Doolin can't blow his own nose without an instruction manual.
That may be true, but Canning Township is county, not city, which makes it the sheriff's jurisdiction. I heard Chief Geller was sending a detective out, but just as a courtesy.
Hoskins.
Yeah, that was the name. He's not here yet, and by the time he makes it, everyone will be gone. Maybe he got lost.
More like stopped somewhere for a few pops, Ralph thought. Yoon said,
those clothes will end up in an evidence box at the sheriff's department, and they'll still be there when the 22nd century dawns. No one gives a shit. The feeling is Maitland did it. Maitland's dead. Let's move on.
I'm not ready to do that, Ralph said, and smiled when Jeannie, sitting on the sofa, made fists and popped two thumbs up.
Are you? Would I be talking to you if I was? Where should we meet tomorrow?
There's a little coffee shop near the train station in Dubrow. O'Malley's Irish Spoon, it's called. Can you find it?
No doubt.
10 o'clock?
Sounds good. If I have to roll on something, I'll call and reschedule.
You have all the witness statements, right?
On my laptop.
Make sure you bring it. All my stuff is at the station, and I'm not supposed to be there. Got a lot to tell you.
Same here, Yoon said. We may crack this yet, Ralph, but I don't know if we'll like what we find. This is a pretty deep forest.
Actually, Ralph thought as he ended the call, it's a cantaloupe, and the damn thing is full of maggots.
21.
Jack Hoskins stopped at Gentleman Please on his way to the Elfman property. He ordered a vodka tonic, which he felt he deserved after being called back from his vacation early. He gulped it, then ordered another, which he sipped. There were two strippers on stage, both still fully dressed, which in gentlemen meant they were wearing bras and panties, but humping at each other in a lazy way that gave Jack a moderate boner. When he took out his wallet to pay, the bartender waved it away.
On the house.
Thanks. Jack dropped a tip on the bar and left feeling in a marginally better mood. As he got moving again, he took a roll of breath mints from the glove box and crunched a couple. People said vodka was odorless, but that was bullshit. The ranch road had been strung off with yellow police tape. County, not city. Hoskins got out, pulled up one of the stakes the tape was tied to, drove through, and replaced the stake. Fucking pain in the ass, he thought, and the ass pain only deepened when he arrived at a cluster of ramshackle buildings, a barn and three sheds, to discover no one was there. He tried to call in, wanting to share his frustration with someone, even if it was only Sandy McGill, who he regarded as a prissy twat of the first order. All he got was static on the radio, and of course there was no cell service out here in South Jerkoff. He grabbed his long-barreled flashlight and got out, mostly to stretch his legs. There was nothing to be done here. It was a fool's errand. He was the fool. A hard wind was blowing.
hot breath that would be a brush fire's best friend if one got started. There was a grove of cottonwoods clustered around an old water pump. Their leaves danced and rustled, their shadows racing across the ground in the moonlight. There was more yellow tape stretched across the entrance to the barn where the clothes had been found. Bagged and on their way to Cap City by now, of course, but it was still creepy to think that Maitland had come here at some point after killing the kid. In a way, Jack thought, I'm retracing his path. Past the boat landing where he changed out of his bloody clothes, then to Gentlemen Please. He went to Dubrow from the Titty Bar, but then he must have circled back to here. The open barn door was like a gaping mouth. Hoskins didn't want to go near it, not out here in the middle of nowhere, and not on his own. Maitland was dead, and there were no such things as ghosts, but he still didn't want to go near it. So he made himself do just that. Step by slow step until he could shine his light inside. Someone was standing at the rear of the barn. Jack uttered a soft cry, reached for his sidearm, and realized he wasn't wearing it. The Glock was in the small guardall safe he kept in his truck. He dropped the flashlight. He bent and scooped it up, feeling the vodka surging around in his head, not enough to make him drunk, just enough to make him feel woozy and unsteady on his feet. He shone the light back into the barn and laughed. There was no man, just the hame of an old harness neatly busted into two pieces. Time to get out of here. Maybe stop at Gentlemen's for one more drink, then home and straight to There was someone behind him, and this was no illusion. He could see the shadow, long and thin. And was that breathing? In a second he's going to grab me. I need to drop and roll. Only he couldn't. He was frozen. Why hadn't he turned around when he saw the scene was deserted? Why hadn't he gotten his gun out of the safe? Why had he ever gotten out of the truck in the first place? Jack suddenly understood that he was going to die at the end of a dirt road in Canning Township. That was when he was touched, caressed on the back of his neck by a hand as hot as a hot water bottle. He tried to scream and couldn't. His chest was locked up like the Glock in its safe. Now another hand would join the first and the choking would begin. Only the hand pulled back, not the fingers, though. They moved back and forth, lightly. Just the tips, playing across his skin and leaving trails of heat. Jack didn't know how long he stood there, unable to move. It might have been 20 seconds. It might have been 2 minutes. The wind blew, tousling his hair and caressing his neck like those fingers. The shadows of the cottonwoods schooled across the dirt and weeds like fleeing fish. The person, or the thing, stood behind him, its shadow long and thin, touching and caressing. Then both the fingertips and the shadow were gone. Jack wheeled around, and this time the scream came out long and loud when the tail of his sport coat belled out behind him in the wind and made a flapping sound. He stared at nothing. Just a few abandoned buildings and an acre or so of dirt. No one was there. No one had ever been there. No one in the barn. Just a busted hame. No fingers on the back of his sweaty neck, just the wind. He returned to his truck in big strides, looking back over his shoulder once, twice, three times. He got in cringing when a wind-driven shadow raced across the rearview mirror and started the engine. He drove back down the ranch road at 50 miles an hour, past the old graveyard and the abandoned ranch house, not pausing at the yellow tape this time, but simply driving through it.
He swerved onto Highway 79, tires squalling, and headed back toward FC. By the time he passed the city limits, he had convinced himself nothing had happened out there at that abandoned barn. The throbbing at the nape of his neck also meant nothing. Nothing at all. Yellow. July 21st through July 22nd. 1. At 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, O'Malley's Irish Spoon was as close to deserted as it ever got. Two geezers sat near the front with mugs of coffee beside them and a chessboard between them. The only waitress was staring, transfixed, at a small TV over the counter where an infomercial was playing. The item on sale appeared to be some sort of golf club. Eunell Sablo was sitting at a table toward the rear, dressed in faded jeans and a T-shirt tight enough to show off his admirable musculature. Ralph had not had admirable musculature since 2007 or so. He was also watching the TV, but when he saw Ralph, he raised a hand and beckoned. As he sat down, Yoon said, "I don't know why the waitress is so interested in that particular club. Women don't golf? What kind of male chauvinist world are you living in, amigo? I know women golf, but that particular club is hollow. The idea is if you get caught short on the 14th hole, you can piss in it. There's even a little apron included that you can flip over your junk. A thing like that wouldn't work for a woman." The waitress came over to take their order. Ralph asked for scrambled eggs and rye toast, looking at the menu rather than her, lest he burst into laughter. That was one urge he hadn't expected to struggle against this morning, and a small strained giggle escaped him anyway. It was the thought of the apron that did it. The waitress didn't need to be a mind reader. "Yeah, it might have its funny side," she said. "Unless, that is, your husband's a golf nut with a prostate the size of a grapefruit and you don't know what to get him for his birthday." Ralph met Yoon's eyes, and that tipped them both over. They burst into hearty roars of hilarity that made the chess players look around disapprovingly. "You going to order anything, honey?" the waitress asked Yoon. "Or just drink coffee and laugh about the Comfort 9 iron?" Yoon ordered huevos rancheros. When she was gone, he said, "It's a strange world, S.A., full of strange things. Don't you think so?"
"Given what we're here to talk about, I'd have to agree. What was strange out there in Canning Township?"
"Plenty." Yoon had a leather shoulder bag, the sort of thing Ralph had heard Jack Hoskins refer to, slightingly, as a man purse. From it, he took an iPad mini and a battered case that had seen a lot of hard traveling. Ralph had noticed more and more cops carrying these gadgets and guessed that by 2020, 2025 at the latest, they might entirely replace the traditional cop's notebook. Well, the world moved on. You either moved with it or got left behind. On the whole, he would rather have one of those for his birthday than a Comfort 9 iron. Yoon tapped a couple of buttons and brought up his notes.
"Kid named Douglas Elfman found the discarded clothes late yesterday afternoon. Recognized the horse's head belt buckle from a news report. Called his dad, got in touch with the SP right away. I got there with the crime van around 5:45. The jeans, who knows? Blue jeans just about grow on trees. But I recognize the buckle right away. Look for yourself." He tapped the screen again, and a close-up of the buckle filled the screen. Ralph had no doubt it was the same one that Terry had been wearing in the security cam footage from the Vogel Transportation Center in Dubrow. Talking to himself as well as to Yoon, Ralph said, "Okay, one more link in the chain." He ditches the van behind Shorty's pub, takes the Subaru, ditches that near the Iron Bridge, puts on fresh clothes. 501 jeans, jockey underpants, white athletic socks, and a pretty damn expensive pair of sneakers, plus the belt with a fancy buckle.
Uh-huh. Once he's dressed in clothes with no blood on them, he takes a cab from Gentleman Please to Dubrow,
Only when he gets to the station, he doesn't take the train. Why not? Maybe he was trying to lay a false trail, in which case doubling back was always part of the plan. Or, I have a crazy idea. Want to hear?
Sure, Ralph said.
I think Maitland meant to run. Meant to take that train to Dallas-Fort Worth and keep on going, maybe to Mexico, maybe to California. Why would he want to stay in Flint City after killing the Peterson boy when he knew people had seen him?
Only what?
Only he couldn't bear to leave with that big game on the line. He wanted to coach his kids to one more win, get them to the finals.
That really is crazy.
Crazier than killing the boy in the first place?
Hewn had him there, but Ralph was spared the need to make a reply when their food came. As soon as the waitress left, Ralph said, "Fingerprints on the buckle?" Hewn swiped his mini and showed Ralph another close-up of the horse's head. In this shot, the buckle's silver shine had been dulled by white fingerprint powder. Ralph could see an overlay of prints, like footprints in one of those old learn-to-dance diagrams.
The forensics unit had Maitland's dabs in their computer, Hewn said, and the program matched them up right away. But here's the first weird thing, Ralph. The lines and whorls in the buckle prints are faint and entirely broken up in a few places. Enough for a match that would stand up in court, but the tech who did the work, and he's done thousands of these, said they were like the prints of an old person, like 80 or even 90. I asked if it could have been because Maitland was moving fast, wanting to change to yet another set of clothes and just get the hell out of there. The tech said it was possible, but I could tell from his face that it didn't really ring his bell.
Huh, Ralph said, and dug into his scrambled eggs. His appetite, like his sudden burst of laughter over the dual-purpose golf club, was a welcome surprise. That is weird, but probably not substantive. And just how long, he wondered, was he going to continue dismissing the anomalies that kept popping up in this business by calling them non-substantive?
There was another set, Hewn said. They were also blurred. Too blurred for the computer tech to even bother sending them out to the FBI's national database. But he had all the stray prints from the van and those other prints on the buckle. See what you think.
He passed the iPad to Ralph. Here were two sets of prints, one labeled Van, unknown sub, and the other Belt Buckle, unknown sub. They did look alike, but only sort of. No way would they stand up in court as proof of anything, especially if a bulldog defense attorney like Howie Gold challenged them. Ralph was not in court, however, and he thought the same unsub had made them both, because it fit with what he'd learned from Marcy Maitland the night before. Not a perfect fit, no, but close enough for a detective on administrative leave who didn't have to run everything by his superiors or by a district attorney hell-bent for election. While Hewn ate his huevos rancheros, Ralph told him about his meeting with Marcy, holding back one thing for later. "It's all about the van," he finished. "Forensics may find a few prints from the kid who originally stole it."
"Already did. We had Merlin Cassidy's prints from the El Paso police. Computer guy matched them to some of the stray prints in the van, mostly on the toolbox, which Cassidy must have opened to see if there was anything valuable inside. They're clear. They're not these."
He swiped back to the blurry unsub prints, labeled Van and Belt Buckle. Ralph leaned forward, pushing his plate aside. "You see how it dovetails, don't you? We know it wasn't Terry who stole the van in Dayton because the Maitlands flew home. But if the blurry prints from the van and those from the buckle really are the same..."
"You think he had an accomplice, after all? One who drove the van from Dayton to Flint City?"
"Must have," Ralph said. "No other way to explain it."
"One who looked just like him?"
"Back to that," Ralph said and sighed.
"And both sets of prints were on the buckle," Hewn pushed on. "Meaning Maitland and his double wore the same belt, maybe the whole set of clothes. Well, they'd fit, wouldn't they? twin brother, separated at birth, except the records say Terry Maitland was an only child.
What else have you got? Anything?
Yes, we have arrived at the really weird shit.
He brought his chair around and sat next to Ralph. The picture now on his iPad showed a close-up of the jeans, socks, underpants, and sneakers, all in an untidy pile next to a plastic evidence marker with a 1 on it.
See the stains?
Yes. What is that crap?
I don't know, Yoon said. And the forensics guys don't either. But one of them said it looked like jizz, and I sort of agree with that. You can't see it in the picture very well, but...
Semen? Are you kidding? The waitress came back.
Ralph turned the iPad screen side down.
Either of you gents want a refill on the coffee?
They both took one. When she left, Ralph went back to the photo of the clothes, spreading his fingers on the screen to enlarge the image. Yoon, it's on the crotch of the jeans, all down both legs, on the cuffs.
Also on the underpants and socks, Yoon said. Not to mention the sneakers, both on 'em and in 'em. Dried to a nice crack glaze like on pottery. Might be enough of the stuff, whatever it is, to fill a hollow 9-iron.
Ralph didn't laugh. It can't be semen. Even John Holmes in his prime.
I know. And semen doesn't do this.
He swiped the screen. The new picture was a wide shot of the barn floor. Another evidence tab, this one marked 2, had been placed next to a pile of loose hay. At least Ralph thought it was hay. On the far left side of the photo, evidence tab 3 had been placed atop a softly collapsing bale that looked like it had been there for a long, long time. Much of it was black. The side of the bale was also black, as if some corrosive goo had run down it to the floor.
Is it the same stuff? Ralph asked.
You're sure?
90%. There's more in the loft. If it's semen, that would be a nocturnal emission worthy of the Guinness Book of Records.
Can't be, Ralph said low. There's something else. For one thing, semen wouldn't turn hay black. It makes no sense.
Not to me either. But of course I am just the son of a poor Mexican farming family.
Forensics is analyzing it, though.
You nodded.
As we speak.
And you'll let me know.
Yes. You see what I meant when I said this just keeps getting weirder and weirder.
Jeannie called it inexplicable. Ralph cleared his throat. She actually used the word supernatural.
My Gabriella has suggested the same, Yoon said. Maybe it's a chick thing, or a Mexican thing.
Ralph raised his eyebrows.
Si, senor,
Yoon said and laughed.
My wife's mother died young, and she grew up at her abuela's knee. The old lady stuffed her full of legends. When I was talking this mess over with her, Gabby told me one about the Mexican boogeyman. He was supposedly a dude dying of tuberculosis, see, and this old wise man who lived in a desert, an ermitaño, told him he could be cured by drinking the blood of children and rubbing their fat on his chest in privates. So that's what this boogeyman did. Now he lives forever. Supposedly he only takes children who misbehave. He pops them in a big black bag he carries. Gabby told me that when she was a little girl, maybe 7. She had a screaming fit one time when the doctor came to the house for her brother who had scarlet fever.
Because the doctor had a black bag. You nodded.
What was that boogeyman's name? It's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't pick it off. Don't you hate that?
So is that what you think we've got here? The boogeyman?
Nope. I may be the son of a poor Mexican farming family, essay, or possibly the son of an Amarillo car dealer, but either way, I ain't atontado. A man killed Frank Peterson, as mortal as you and me, and that man was almost certainly Terry Maitland. If we could figure out what happened, everything would fall into place, and I could go back to sleeping through the night,
because this bugs the shit out of me.
He looked at his watch.
Gotta go. Promised my wife I'd take her to a craft fair in Cap City. Any more questions? You ought to have at least one, because yet one more weird thing is staring you right in the face.
Were there vehicle tracks in the barn?
That's not what I was thinking of, but as a matter of fact, there were. Not useful ones, though. You can see the impressions, and there's a little oil, but no tread marks good enough for comparison. My guess is they were made by the van Maitland used to abduct the kid. They weren't close enough together to have been made by the Subaru.
Uh-huh. Listen, you've got all the witness interviews on your magic gadget, right? Before you split, find the one I did with Claude Bolton. He's a bouncer at Gentleman Please, although he took issue with that word, as I remember. Yoon brought up one file, shook his head, brought up another, and handed the iPad to Ralph.
Scroll down.
Ralph did so, went past what he wanted, and at last centered on it. Here it is. Bolton said, "I remember one other thing. No big deal, but kind of spooky if he really was the one who killed that kid. Bolton said the guy cut him. When I asked what he meant, Bolton said he thanked Maitland for working with his friend's nephews, then shook with him. When he did, Maitland's pinky fingernail grazed the back of Bolton's hand, made a little cut. Bolton said it reminded him of his drug days because some of the MCs he ran with used to grow out their pinky nails to scoop coke with. Apparently it was a fashion statement."
"And this is important because..."
Yoon looked at his watch again rather ostentatiously. "Probably it's not. Probably it's..." But he wasn't going to say non-substantive again. He liked the word less every time it came out of his mouth. "Probably no big deal, but it's what my wife calls a confluence. Terry got a similar cut when he was visiting his father in a dementia ward in Dayton." Ralph quickly related the story about how the orderly had slipped and grabbed for Terry, cutting him in the process.
Yoon thought about it, then shrugged. "I think that's one pure coincidence, Essay. And I really have to go if I don't want to incur the wrath of Gabriella. But there's still that thing you're missing, and I'm not talking about tire tracks. Your pal Bolton even mentions it. Scroll back up and you'll find it."
But Ralph didn't need to. It had been right in front of him. Pants, underpants, socks and sneakers, but no shirt.
"Correct," Yoon said. "Either it was his favorite, or he didn't have another one to change into when he left the barn."
2. Halfway back to Flint City, Ralph finally realized what had been bugging him about the bra strap. He pulled into the 2-acre lot of a Byron's liquor warehouse and hit speed dial. His call went to Yoon's voicemail. Ralph broke the connection without leaving a message. Yoon had already gone above and beyond, let him have his weekend. And now that he had time to give it a little thought, Ralph decided this was a confluence he didn't want to share with anyone, except maybe his wife. The bra strap hadn't been the only bright yellow thing he had seen during those moments of hypervigilance before Terry was shot. It was just his brain's stand-in for something that had been part of the larger gallery of grotesques, and overshadowed by Ollie Peterson, who had drawn the old revolver from his newspaper bag only seconds later. No wonder it had gotten lost. The man with the horrible burns on his face and the tattoos on his hands had been wearing a yellow bandana on his head, probably to cover more scars. But had it been a bandana? Couldn't it have been something else? The missing shirt, for instance? The one Terry had been wearing in the train station? "I'm reaching," he thought. And maybe he was, except his subconscious, those thoughts behind his thoughts, had been yelling at him about it all along. He closed his eyes and tried to summon up exactly what he'd seen in those last few seconds of Terry's life.
The blonde anchor's unlovely sneer as she looked at the blood on her fingers. The hypodermic sign reading, "Maitland, take your medicine." The boy with the bad lip. The woman leaning forward to give Marcy the finger. And the burned man, who'd looked as if God had taken a giant eraser to most of his features, leaving only lumps, raw pink skin, and holes where a nose had been before the fire had put tattoos on his face far fiercer than those on his hands. And what Ralph saw in this moment of recall was not a bandana on that man's head, but something far bigger, something that hung all the way down to his shoulders like a headdress. Yes, that something could have been a shirt. But even if it was, did that mean it was the shirt? The one Terry had been wearing in the security footage? Was there a way to find out? He thought there was, but he needed to enlist Jeannie, who was far more computer savvy than he was. Also, the time might have come to stop thinking of Howard Gold and Alec Pelley as enemies. "Maybe we're all on the same side here," Pelley had said last night as he stood on the Maitland stoop, and maybe that was true. Or could be. Ralph put his car in gear and headed home, pushing the speed limit all the way. 3. Ralph and his wife sat at the kitchen table with Jeannie's laptop in front of them. There were 4 major TV stations in Cap City, one for each of the networks, plus Channel 81, the public access outlet that ran local news, city council meetings, and various community affairs, such as the Harlan Coben speech where Terry had appeared as an unlikely guest star. All 5 had been at the courthouse for Terry's arraignment. All 5 had filmed the shooting, and all had at least some footage of the crowd. Once the gunfire erupted, all the cameras turned to Terry, of course. Terry bleeding down the side of his face and pushing his wife from the line of fire, then collapsing into the street when the kill shot struck him. The CBS footage went entirely blank before that happened, because that was the camera Ralph's bullet had struck, shattering it and blinding its operator in one eye. After they'd looked at each clip twice, Jeannie turned to him, her lips pressed tightly together. She didn't say anything. She didn't have to. "Run the Channel 81 stuff again," Ralph said. "Their camera was every which way once the shooting started, but they got the best crowd stuff before."
"Ralph," she touched his arm, "are you all right?"
"Fine. I'm fine." He wasn't. He felt as if the world were tilting and he might soon slide right off the edge. "Run it again, please, and mute it. The reporter's running commentary is distracting." She did as he asked, and they watched together. Waving signs, people yelling soundlessly, their mouths opening and closing like fish out of water. At one point, the camera panned rapidly across and down, not soon enough to show the man who had spit in Terry's face, but in time to show Ralph tripping the troublemaker, making it look like an unprovoked attack. He watched as Terry helped the spitter to his feet, like something out of the fucking Bible, Ralph remembered thinking. And then the camera returned to the crowd. He saw the 2 bailiffs, one plump, the other lean, doing their best to keep the steps clear. He saw the blonde anchor from Channel 7 getting to her feet, still looking with disbelief at her bloody fingers. He saw Ollie Peterson with his newspaper sack and a few clumps of red hair sticking out from beneath his watch cap, still a few seconds from being the star of the show. He saw the boy with the cleft lip, the Channel 81 cameraman pausing his shot long enough to register Frank Peterson's face on the boy's T-shirt before panning further. "Stop," he said. "Freeze it. Freeze it right there." Jeannie did so, and they looked at the picture, slightly blurred from the cameraman's rapid movement as he tried to get a little bit of everything. Ralph tapped the screen. "See this guy waving the cowboy hat?"
"Sure."
The burn man was standing right next to him.
"All right," she said, but in a strange, nervous tone of voice Ralph did not remember ever hearing from her before.
I swear to you, he was. I saw him. It was like I was tripping on LSD or mescaline or something, and I saw everything. Run the other ones again. This is the best one of the crowd, but the Fox affiliate wasn't too bad, and...
No. She hit the power button and closed the laptop. The man you saw isn't in any of these, Ralph. You know it as well as I do.
Do you think I'm crazy? Is that it? Do you think I'm having a, you know,
a breakdown? Her hand was back on his arm again, now squeezing gently. Of course not. If you say you saw him, you saw him. If you think he was wearing that shirt as a kind of sun protection or do-rag or I don't know what, then he probably was.
You've had a bad month, probably the worst month of your life, but I trust your powers of observation.
It's just that you must see now.
She trailed off. He waited. At last, she pushed ahead.
There's something very wrong with this, and the more you find, the wronger it gets. It scares me. That story Yoon told you scares me. It's basically a vampire story, isn't it? I read Dracula in high school, and one thing I remember about it is vampires don't cast reflections in mirrors. And a thing that can't cast a reflection probably wouldn't show up in TV news footage.
That's nuts. There's no such thing as ghosts or witches or vamp.
She slapped her open hand down on the table, a flat pistol shot sound that made him jump. Her eyes were furious, crackling.
Wake up, Ralph. Wake up to what's right in front of you. Terry Maitland was in two places at the same time. If you stop trying to find a way to explain that away and just accept it.
I can't accept it, honey. It goes against everything I've believed my whole life. If I let something like that in, I really would go crazy.
The hell you would.
You're stronger than that. But you don't have to even consider the idea. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Terry's dead. You can let it go.
If I do that, and it really wasn't Terry who killed Frankie Peterson, where does that leave Marcy? Where does it leave her girls?
Jeannie got up, walked to the window over the sink, and looked out at the backyard. Her hands were clenched into fists. Derek called again. He still wants to come home.
What did you tell him?
To stick it out until the season ends in the middle of next month. Even though I'd love to have him home, I finally talked him into it, and do you know why? She turned back. Because I don't want him in this town while you're still digging around in this mess. Because when it gets dark tonight, I'm going to be frightened. Suppose it really is some kind of supernatural creature, Ralph. And what if it finds out you're looking for it?
Ralph took her in his arms. He could feel her trembling. He thought, part of her actually believes this.
Yoon told me that story, but Yoon believes the killer is a natural man. So do I.
With her face against his chest, she said, then why isn't the man with the burned face in any of the footage?
I don't know.
I care about Marcy. Of course I do. She looked up, and he saw she was crying. I care about her girls. I care about Terry, for that matter, and the Petersons. But I care more about you and Derek. You guys are all I have. Can't you let this go now? Finish your leave, see the shrink, and turn the page?
I don't know, he said, when in fact he did know. He just didn't want to say so to Jeannie while she was in her current strange state. He couldn't turn the page. Not yet.
4.
That night, he sat at the picnic table in the backyard, smoking a Tipperillo and looking up at the sky. There were no stars, but he could still make out the moon behind the clouds that were moving in. The truth was often like that, he thought. A bleary circle of light behind clouds. Sometimes it broke through. Sometimes the clouds thickened and the light disappeared completely. One thing was sure. When night fell, the skinny, tubercular man from Yun Sablo's fairy tale became more plausible. Not believable. Ralph could no more believe in such a creature than he could in Santa Claus, but he could picture him, a darker-skinned version of Slender Man, that bugaboo of pubescent American girls. He'd be tall and grave in his black suit, his face like a lamp, and carrying a bag big enough to hold a small child with his or her knees folded against his or her chest. According to Yoon, the Mexican boogeyman prolonged his life by drinking the blood of children and rubbing their fat on his body. And while that wasn't exactly what had happened to the Peterson boy, it was in the vicinity. Might it be possible that the killer, maybe Maitland, maybe the unsub of the blurred fingerprints, actually thought he was a vampire or some other supernatural creature? Hadn't Jeffrey Dahmer believed he was creating zombies when he killed all those homeless men? None of that addresses the question of why the burn man isn't in the news footage. Jeannie called to him.
Come inside, Ralph. It's going to rain. You can smoke that smelly thing in the kitchen if you have to have it.
That isn't why you want me to come inside, Ralph thought. You want me to come in because part of you can't help thinking that Yoon Sackman is lurking out here, just beyond the reach of the yard light. Ridiculous, of course, but he could sympathize with her unease. He felt it himself. What had Jeannie said? The more you find, the wronger it gets. Ralph came inside, doused his Tipperillo under the sink tap, then grabbed his phone off the charging stand. When Howie answered, Ralph said, "Can you and Mr. Pelly come over here tomorrow? I have a bunch of stuff to tell you, and some of it's pretty unbelievable. Come to lunch. I'll go out to Rudy's and buy some sandwiches." Howie agreed at once. Ralph broke the connection and saw Jeannie in the doorway, looking at him with her arms folded over her chest.
"Can't let it go."
"No, honey, I can't. I'm sorry."
She sighed. "Will you be careful?"
"I'll tread with utmost caution."
"You better, or I'll tread on you without caution. And no need to get sandwiches from Rudy's. I'll make something."
5. Sunday was rainy, so they convened at the Anderson's seldom-used dining room table. Ralph, Jeannie, Howie, and Alec. Yoon Sablo at home in Cap City joined them on Howie Gold's laptop via Skype. Ralph began by recapping the things all of them knew, then turned it over to Yoon, who told Howie and Alec about what they had found in the Elfman barn. When he was finished, Howie said, "None of this makes sense. In fact, it's about 4 time zones from making sense."
"This person was sleeping out there in the loft of a deserted barn," Alec asked Yoon. "Hiding out? That's what you're thinking?"
"It's a working assumption," Yoon said.
"If so, it couldn't have been Terry," Howie said. "He was in town all day Saturday. He took the girls to the municipal pool that morning, and he was at Estelle Barga Park all that afternoon getting the field ready. As the home field coach, doing that was his responsibility. There were plenty of witnesses in both places."
"And from Saturday till Monday," Alec put in, "he was jugged in county jail, as you well know, Ralph."
"There are all kinds of witnesses to Terry's whereabouts almost every step of the way," Ralph agreed. "That's always been the root of the problem. But let it go for a minute. I want to show you something. Yoon's already seen it. He reviewed the footage this morning. But I asked him something before he watched, and now I want to ask you. Did either of you notice a badly disfigured man at the courthouse? He was wearing something on his head, but I'm not going to say what it was just now. Either of you?" Howie said he hadn't. All his attention had been fixed on his client and his client's wife. Alec Pelly, however, was a different matter.
"Yeah, I saw him. Looked like he got burned in a fire. And what he was wearing on his head..."
He stopped, eyes widening.
"Go on,"
Yoon said from his living room in Cap City.
Let it out, amigo. You'll feel better.
Alec was rubbing his temples as if he had a headache.
At the time, I thought it was a bandana or a kerchief. You know, because his hair got burned off in the fire and maybe couldn't grow back because of the scarring, and he wanted to keep the sun off his skull. Only it could have been a shirt. The one missing from the barn, is that what you're thinking? The one Terry was wearing in the security footage from the train station?
You win the Cupid doll, Yoon said. Howie was frowning at Ralph. You're still trying to hang this on Terry?
Jeannie spoke up for the first time. He's just trying to get to the truth, which I'm not sure is the world's best idea, actually.
Watch this, Alec, Ralph said, and point out the burned man. Ralph ran the Channel 81 footage, then the Fox footage, and then, at Alec's request, he was now leaning so close to Jeannie's laptop that his nose was nearly touching the screen, the Channel 81 footage again. At last he sat back.
He's not there, which is impossible.
Yoon said.
He was standing next to the guy waving his cowboy hat, right? I think so, Alec said. Next to him and higher up from the blonde reporter who got bonked on the noggin with a sign. I see both the reporter and the sign waver, but I don't see him. How can that be?
None of them answered. Howie said, let's go back to the fingerprints for a minute. How many different sets in the van, Yoon?
Forensics thinks as many as half a dozen.
Howie groaned.
Take it easy. We've eliminated at least four of those. The farmer in New York who owned the van, the farmer's oldest son who sometimes drove it, the kid who stole it, and Terry Maitland. That leaves one clear set we haven't identified. Could have been one of the farmer's friends or one of his younger kids playing around inside. And those blurry ones.
The same blurry ones you found on the belt buckle.
Probably, but we can't be sure. There are a few visible lines and whorls in those, but nothing like the clear points of identity you'd need to get them admitted into evidence when a case goes to court.
Uh-huh. Okay. Understood. So let me ask all three of you gentlemen something. Isn't it possible that a man who had been badly burned, hands as well as face, could leave prints like that? Ones blurred to unrecognizability? Yes, Yoon and Alec said in unison, their voices only overlapping because of the computer's brief transmission lag. The problem with that, Ralph said, is the burned man at the courthouse had tattoos on his hands. If his fingertips burned off, wouldn't the tats have burned off too? Howie shook his head.
Not necessarily. If I'm on fire, maybe I use my hands to try and put myself out. But I don't do it with the backs, do I?
He began slapping at his considerable chest to demonstrate. I do it with my palms. There was a moment of silence. Then, in a low, almost inaudible voice, Alec Pelley said,
that burned guy was there. I'd swear it on a stack of Bibles.
Ralph said, presumably the state police forensics unit will analyze the stuff from the barn that turned the hay black, but is there anything we can do in the meantime? I'm open to suggestions.
Backtrack to Dayton, Alec said. We know Maitland was there, and we know the van was there, too. At least some of the answers may also be there. I can't fly up myself, too many irons currently in the fire, but I know somebody good. Let me make a call and see if he's available.
That was where they left it. 6.
10-year-old Grace Maitland had slept poorly ever since her father's murder, and what sleep she had managed was haunted by nightmares. That Sunday afternoon, all her weariness came down on her like a soft weight. While her mother and sister were making a cake in the kitchen, Grace crept upstairs and lay on her bed. Although the day was rainy, there was plenty of light, which was good. The dark scared her now.
Downstairs she could hear Mom and Sarah talking. That was also good. Grace closed her eyes, and although it only felt like a moment or two before she opened them again, it must have been hours, because the rain was coming down harder now, and the light had gone gray. Her room was full of shadows. A man was sitting on her bed and looking at her. He was wearing jeans and a green t-shirt. There were tattoos on his hands and crawling up his arms. There were snakes, and a cross, and a dagger, and a skull. His face no longer looked like it had been made out of Play-Doh by an untalented child, but she recognized him just the same. It was the man who had been outside Sarah's window. At least now he didn't have straws for eyes. Now he had her father's eyes. Grace would have known those eyes anywhere. She wondered if this was happening, or if it was a dream. If so, it was better than the nightmares. A little, anyway. Daddy?
Sure, said the man.
His green t-shirt changed to her father's Golden Dragons game shirt, and so she knew it was a dream, after all. Next, that shirt turned into a white, smocky thing, then back into the green t-shirt.
I love you, Gracie.
That doesn't sound like him, Grace said. You're making him up. The man leaned close to her. Grace shrank back, eyes fixed on her father's eyes. They were better than the I love you voice, but this was still not him. I want you to go, she said.
I'm sure you do. And people in hell want ice water. Are you sad, Grace? Do you miss your daddy?
Yes, Grace began to cry. I want you to go. Those aren't my daddy's real eyes. You're just pretending.
Don't expect any sympathy from me, the man said. I think it's good that you're sad. I hope you'll be sad for a long time and cry. Wah, 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 just like a baby.
Please go.
Baby want her bottle? Baby pee in her diapers get all wet? Baby go wah, wah, wah.
Stop it! He sat back.
I will. If you do one thing for me, will you do something for me, Grace?
What is it?
He told her. And then Sarah was shaking her and telling her to come down and have some cake. So it had just been a dream after all. A bad dream. And she didn't have to do anything.
But if she did, that dream might never come back.
She made herself eat some cake, although she really didn't want any. And when Mom and Sarah were sitting on the couch and watching some dippy movie, Grace said she didn't like love movies and was going upstairs to play Angry Birds. Only she didn't. She went into her parents' bedroom, just her mom's now, and how sad that was, and took her mother's cell phone off the dresser. The policeman wasn't in the cell's contact list, but Mr. Gold was. She called him, holding the phone in both hands so it wouldn't shake. She prayed he would answer, and he did.
Marcy, what's up?
No, it's Grace. I'm using my mom's phone.
Why, hello, Grace. It's nice to hear from you. Why are you calling?
Because I didn't know how to call the detective, the one who arrested my father.
Why do you...
I have a message for him. A man gave it to me. I know it was probably just a dream, but I'm playing it safe. I'll tell you, and you can tell the detective.
What man, Grace? Who gave you the message?
The first time I saw him, he had straws for eyes. He says he won't come back anymore if I give Detective Anderson the message. He tried to make me believe he had my daddy's eyes, but he didn't, not really. His face is better now, but he's still scary. I don't want him to come back, even if it's only a dream, so will you tell Detective Anderson?
Mom was in the doorway now, silently watching, and Grace thought she would probably get in trouble, but she didn't care.
What should I tell him, Grace? To stop. If he doesn't want something bad to happen, tell him he has to stop.
7. Grace and Sarah sat in the living room on the couch. Marcy was between them with an arm around each. Howie Gold sat in the easy chair that had been Terry's until the world turned upside down. A hassock went with it. Ralph Anderson drew it in front of the couch and sat on it, his legs so long that his knees almost framed his face. He supposed he looked comical. And if that set Grace Maitland a bit at ease, that was all to the good.
That must have been a scary dream, Grace. Are you sure it was a dream?
Of course it was, Marcy said. Her face was tight and pale. There was no man in this house. There was no way he could have gotten upstairs without us seeing him.
Or heard him, at least, Sarah put in, but she sounded timid, afraid.
Our stairs creak like mad.
You're here for one reason, to ease my daughter's mind, Marcy said. Would you please do that?
Ralph said, Whatever it was, you know there's no man here now, don't you, Grace?
Yes. She seemed sure of this. He's gone. He said he would go if I gave you the message. I don't think he will come back anymore, whether he was a dream or not.
Sarah sighed dramatically and said,
Isn't that a relief?
Hush, Munchkin, Marcy said.
Ralph pulled out his notebook. Tell me what he looked like, this man in your dream, because I'm a detective and now I'm sure that's what it was. Although Marcy Maitland didn't like him and probably never would, her eyes thanked him for this much at least.
Better, Grace said. He looked better. His Play-Doh face was gone.
That's what he looked like before, Sarah told Ralph. She said.
Marcy said, Sarah, go into the kitchen with Mr. Gold and get everybody a piece of cake. Would you do that?
Sarah looked at Ralph.
Cake even for him? Do we like him now?
Cake for everyone, Marcy said, neatly dodging the question. It's called hospitality. Go on now.
Sarah got off the couch and crossed the room to Howie.
I'm getting kicked out.
Couldn't happen to a nicer person, Howie said. I will join you in Perda.
In what?
Never mind, kiddo.
They went out to the kitchen together.
Make this brief, please, Marcy said to Ralph. You're only here because Howie said it was important, that it might have something to do with, you know.
Ralph nodded without taking his eyes from Grace.
This man who had the Play-Doh face the first time he showed up.
And straws for eyes, Grace said. They stuck out like in a cartoon, and the black circles people have in their eyes were holes.
Uh-huh.
In his notebook, Ralph wrote, Straws for eyes?
When you say his face looked like Play-Doh, could it have been because he was burned?
She thought about it. No. More like he wasn't done, not, you know.
Not finished? Marcy asked.
Grace nodded and put her thumb in her mouth.
Ralph thought, this 10-year-old thumbsucker with the wounded face, she's mine.
True, and the seeming clarity of the evidence upon which he had acted would never change that.
What did he look like today, Grace, the man in your dream?
He had short black hair that was sticking up like a porcupine and a little beard around his mouth. He had my daddy's eyes, but they weren't really his eyes. He had tattoos on his hands and all up his arms. Some were snakes. At first his shirt was green, then it turned to my daddy's baseball shirt with a golden dragon on it. Then it turned into white, like what Mrs. Gerson wears when she does my mom's hair. Ralph glanced at Marcy, who said, "I think she means a smock top." "Yes," Grace said, "that. But then it turned back into the green shirt, so I know it was a dream. Only..." Her mouth trembled, and her eyes filled with tears that spilled down her flushed cheeks. "Only he said mean things. He said he was glad I was sad. He called me a baby." She turned her face against her mother's breasts and wept. Marcy looked at Ralph over the top of her head for a moment, not angry at him, but only frightened for her daughter. "She knows it was more than a dream," Ralph thought. "She sees it mean something to me." When the girl's crying eased, Ralph said, "This is all good, Grace. Thank you for telling me about your dream. All that's over now, okay?" "Yes," she said in a tear-hoarsened voice. "He's gone. I did what he said, and he's gone."
"We'll have our cake in here," Marcy said. "Go help your sister with the plates." Grace ran to do it. When they were alone, Marcy said, "It's been hard on both of them, especially Grace. I'd say that's all this is, except Howie doesn't think so, and I don't think you do either, do you?" "Mrs. Maitland, Marcy, I don't know what to think. Have you checked Grace's room?"
"Of course, as soon as she told me why she called Howie."
"No sign of an intruder?"
"No, the window was shut, the screen was in place, and what Sarah said about the stairs is true. This is an old house, and there's a creak in every step."
"What about her bed? Grace said the man was sitting there." Marcy gave a distracted laugh.
"Who would know the way she tosses and turns since..." She put a hand to her face. "This is just so awful."
He got up and went to the couch, only meaning to comfort, but she stiffened and drew away.
"Please don't sit down. And don't touch me. You're here on sufferance, detective. So just maybe my youngest will sleep tonight without screaming the house down."
Ralph was saved a reply when Howie and the Maitland girls came back in, Grace carefully carrying a plate in each hand. Marcy wiped her eyes, the gesture almost too fast to see, and gave Howie and her daughters a brilliant smile.
"Hooray for cake," she said.
Ralph took his slice and said, "Thank you." He was thinking that he had told Jeannie everything about this fucked-up nightmare of a case, but he wasn't going to tell her about this little girl's dream. No, not this.
8. Alec Pelley thought he had the number he wanted in his contacts, but when he made the call, he got an announcement saying the number had been disconnected. He found his old black address book, once a faithful companion that had gone with him everywhere, in this computer age relegated to a desk drawer, and one of the lower ones at that, and tried a different number.
"The finders, keepers,"
said the voice on the other end. Believing that he'd reached an answering machine, a reasonable assumption considering it was Sunday night, Alec waited for the announcement of office hours, followed by a menu of choices that could be accessed by punching various extensions and at last the invitation to leave a message after the beep. Instead, sounding a bit querulous, the voice said,
"Well, is anyone there?"
Alec realized that was a voice he knew, although he couldn't place the name. How long had it been since he'd spoken to the owner of that voice? 2 years? 3?
"I'm hanging up now."
"Don't. I'm here. My name is Alec Pelley, and I was trying to reach Bill Hodges. I worked with him on a case a few years back, just after I retired from the state police. There was a bad actor named Oliver Madden who stole an airplane from a Texas oil man named..."
"Dwight Cram. I remember, and I remember you, Mr. Pelley, although we've never met. Mr. Cram did not pay us promptly, I'm sorry to say. I had to invoice him at least half a dozen times, and then threaten legal action. I hope you did better."
"It took a little work," Alec said, smiling at the memory. "The first check he sent me bounced, but the second one went through all right. You're Holly, aren't you? I can't remember the last name, but Bill spoke very highly of you."
"Holly Gibney," she said.
Well, it's very nice to speak with you again, Ms. Gibney. I tried Bill's number, but I guess he's changed it.
Silence.
Ms. Gibney, did I lose you?
No, she said. I'm here. Bill died 2 years ago.
Oh, Jesus. I'm very sorry to hear that. Was it his heart?
Although Alec had only met Hodges once, they had done most of their business by phone and email. He had been on the heavy side.
Cancer. Pancreatic. Now, I run the company with Peter Huntley. He was Bill's partner when they were on the force.
Well, good for you.
No, she said. Not good for me. The business is doing quite well, but I would give it up in a minute to have Bill alive and healthy. Cancer is very poopy.
Alec almost thanked her then and ended the call after renewing his condolences. Later on, he wondered how much things would have changed if he had done that. But he remembered something Bill had said about this woman during the business of retrieving Dwight Cram's King Air.
She's eccentric, a little obsessive-compulsive, and she's not big on personal contact, but she never misses a trick. Holly would have made one hell of a police detective.
I was hoping to hire Bill to do some investigating for me, he said, but possibly you could take it on. He really did speak highly of you.
I'm glad to hear it, Mr. Pelly, but I doubt if I'm the right person. Mostly what we do at Finders and Keepers is chase bail jumpers and trace missing persons.
She paused, then added,
there is also the fact that we are quite a distance from you, unless you're calling from somewhere in the Northeast.
I'm not, but my interest happens to be in Ohio, and it would be inconvenient for me to fly up myself. There are things going on here that I need to stick with. How far are you from Dayton?
1 moment, she said, and then almost immediately. 232 miles, according to MapQuest, which is a very good program. What is it you need? Investigate it, Mr. Pelly. And before you answer her, I need to tell you that if it involves any possibility of violence, I really would have to pass on the case. I abhor violence.
No violence, he said. There was violence, the murder of a child, but it happened down here, and the man who was arrested for the crime is dead. The question is whether or not he was the doer, and answering that involves back-checking a trip he made to Dayton with his family in April.
I see. And who would be paying for the company's services? You?
No, an attorney named Howard Gold.
To your knowledge, does Attorney Gold pay more promptly than Dwight Cram?
Alec grinned at that.
Absolutely.
And although the retainer would come from Howie, the entire finder's keeper's fee, assuming Ms. Holly Gibney agreed to take on the Dayton investigation, would in the end come from Marcy Maitland, who would be able to afford it. The insurance company wouldn't like paying out on an accused murderer, but since Terry had never been convicted of anything, they would have no recourse. There was also the wrongful death suit against Flint City that Howie would be lodging on Marcy's behalf. He had told Alec that the city would probably settle for an amount in the low 7 figures. A fat bank account wouldn't bring her husband back, but it could pay for an investigation and a home relocation if Marcy decided that was best, and the college educations of 2 girls when the time came. Money was no cure for sorrow, Alec reflected, but it did allow one to grieve in relative comfort.
Tell me about this case, Mr. Pelly. And I'll tell you if I can take it on.
Doing that will take some time. I can call tomorrow during office hours if that would be better for you.
Tonight is fine. Just give me a moment to turn off the movie I was watching.
I'm interrupting your evening.
Not really. I've seen Paths of Glory at least 12 times. It's one of Mr. Kubrick's finest. Much better than The Shining and Barry Lyndon, in my opinion. But, of course, he was much younger when he made it. Young artists are much more likely to be risk-takers, in my opinion.
I'm not much of a movie buff,
Alec replied, remembering what Hodges had said, eccentric and a little obsessive-compulsive.
They brighten the world. That's what I think. Just 1 second.
In the background, the sound of faint movie music ceased. Then she was back.
Tell me what you need done in Dayton, Mr. Pelly.
It's not just a very long story, it's a strange one. Let me warn you of that in advance.
She laughed, a sound much richer than her usual careful speech. It made her sound younger. Yours won't be the first strange story I've heard. Believe me, when I was with Bill... Well, never mind that. But if we're going to be talking for a while, you might as well call me Holly. I'm going to put you on speaker to free up my hands. Wait. Okay.